We've created curated portfolios on the institutional side, as I mentioned earlier, that are in the $10 to $30 billion range. Mm-hmm. And we've done that by building asset by asset and doing that over time.
Okay, episode 14 of The Deal Ranch. Rick Schau, Clarion Partners, thanks for having me. And Allie in the room as well.
Thank you, Matt. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having a beautiful office. Excited to talk about Clarion today, this fund that obviously you're the manager on. But if you want to give an intro on yourself before we get rolling, that'd be great.
Great. I'm Rick Schau. I'm a portfolio manager and managing director at Clarion Partners. I've been here for over 20 years. And I currently manage a product called Clarion Partners Real Estate Income Fund, which is an exciting product where we've expanded our investor base to the individual investor. But excited to go deep on my career and what we've been doing. So,
absolutely. So a bit of a mammoth here that you guys work at, one of the largest pure play private investment real estate companies really in the world. So you have $80 billion under management. Before we kind of dive into your career and do a couple deal stories, can you break down this company here, kind of what you guys focus on?
Sure. Yeah. Clarion Partners is one of the largest pure play real estate investment managers. We've been around for 40 years and we are a partnership actually. So we are called Clarion Partners. We have partnered with Franklin Templeton, but we also, the partners of the firm own about 18% of our firm, which is a little bit unique in our space and makes it, I think, a bit of an exciting place to work. As for that $80 billion, it's a vast majority institutional money. Yep. So we take capital from some of the largest pension funds in the world to other institutional capital, invest that directly and buy properties. So it's a fairly simple model. We're a fiduciary and we basically act as a fiduciary to buy properties on their behalf. We do that in several ways. One is through what we call separate accounts. So that's where you're a really large fund. We can create a fund essentially just for you, right? That's, you need to invest $200 to $500 million.
What would be an example of that? Like, you're saying a pension fund?
Correct. Okay, right. Cool. So for example, I used to manage for a large corporate pension fund and they said to us, you know, here's $1 billion over time. We call it build decor, build a bunch of properties for us, hold them for the long term and create basically a portfolio just for us. And that was something I did before this last fund. And that's pretty exciting because we typically get discretion in that case and you get to think about investment strategy, how to create a portfolio, and that is how we do. So we create a bespoke vehicle for a separate account. That's one line. That's about a third of our capital.
Yeah.
And then the other two-thirds is commingled funds. Okay. These are private funds targeted for institutional investors. And we have one that's a diversified fund, one that's more warehouse-focused, and one that's multifamily-focused.
Awesome. If we can dive into all these later, I know we've been sitting here chatting for like the last 30 minutes and we got to know each other, but still don't really know how you got started. So you went to school, Notre Dame, for architecture, but now you work on the investment side. So when you finished school, what was the plan after school? Like years ago, what did you want to do after you graduated?
That's a great question. So I since I was little, was always building things and thinking of how to construct things. So I was passionate to go to architecture school. Architecture schools have different types. So there's actually a five-year program, and Notre Dame was one of those, and I was excited to do that. And at that time, and it still is today, actually, Notre Dame is focused on more traditional architecture, classical architecture, and new urbanism.
Sure.
And this was the early to mid-1990s when, for the previous 30 to 40 years, almost all design had been around cars and sprawl, and there was beginning to be a push of reurbanizing the United States and a look at sort of how do we build differently to focus not just on the car, but also for human beings a bit more. And that became my passion. So I really focused on new urbanism and was really seeking to do that for a career when I graduated from college.
So then when you graduated, Cooper Robertson or Robertson and Partners. How did the role come together? What did you do initially?
So I wanted to take that passion and work in that space. And really, at the time, this was, again, late 1990s or mid-1990s, Cooper Robertson was, I think, one of the preeminent firms that was beginning to design, again, our cities. So Alex Cooper is a visionary who designed Battery Park City, which, if you think about it, at that point, most city projects had been, you know, buildings in a park and not doing streets and esplanades and creating places for people. And so he really was the first one, probably, you know, post World War II to start healing our cities and building them sort of as we think of them today. Jack Robertson was Dean of Virginia and really a leader of this classical movement. And they did Celebration, which at the time was really its first kind of community where you design streets.
Celebration, Florida?
Correct, part of the Disney, right? So where, you know, with parks and that type of thing. Now, actually, if you look at most developments, whether they're in the city or whether they're greenfield development, the principles behind all that are really now how we build, right? We build parks, we build streets with sidewalks. But you know, for the 30, 40 years before that, it was all cul-de-sacs, no sidewalks.
Yeah.
And so it really did, that movement did change how we build, and it was an exciting place to be part of it. So.
Wow. That's a unique background. So then what prompted the school or the idea to go back to school and then kind of shift gears towards investment side?
So I had a great run in those 3 years as an architect, you're technically an intern as an architect, and you have to get hours billed, and then you can take an exam to become a licensed architect, and that can happen in about 3 years. So I was at a pivot point where I was either kind of going to study for this test, which is a very intense test, or potentially try something else. And I worked incredibly hard, and I wanted to learn more. I was working with a lot of developers. I'd never done an Excel spreadsheet, and you know, you get told a lot, well, you know, you don't understand the economics. And I'm like, I kind of intuitively do, but I want to learn more. So I really wanted to round out my education and think about how to understand the other side of the business. And I thought, I didn't know where my path would take me when I left architecture to go to business school. But I thought, even if I do come back to architecture, there are great skills to have to you know, run a better business as an architect, right? Yeah. So I think it just kind of opened more doors. And then during that process of going to business school, I think I realized I wanted to be more on the buy side, the investor side, than be a consultant again, kind of thing. So it was, I think, a personality trait.
So when you finished school, how did this come to be? How'd you end up here?
I mean, you, anyone who's young looking for a job, you know, you network and you do your best to get out there. And Clarion was on my radar, and I fortunately got the opportunity to come in and meet folks. And I really enjoyed meeting people here. I think maybe it's a little bit of the partnership culture, but people are smart, they're hardworking, but they're also thoughtful. And they embraced, I think, someone who was a bit more creative, which was, you know, hard to find. You had to find someone who was a little bit willing to take a risk on someone like myself who didn't have investment banking experience and didn't have that sort of quantitative experience. And so it was really a personality fit. And I really wanted to get a broad experience in how to understand all the aspects of real estate to sort of take my next step. And coming to a place like this where you could do asset management acquisitions was a great experience.
Absolutely. So bringing it to a little bit more modern day, and before we talk about the fund that you're managing, can you give an overview? I know we did it a couple seconds ago, but like the asset classes that you guys invest in, your regional approach to it, because you have so many asset managers that focus geographically around the country, but give an overview of where we are today with Clarion and what you guys are focused on.
So as I said, about two-thirds of the business today is more in these commingled funds. But the big picture from an investment process, and I think this is quite similar to most investment managers, we have a research team. So that research team really helps us find sort of top-down themes because obviously thematic investing is important, especially with what's going on in the different sectors. Happy to sort of jump into that as well if you'd like. But then we also do what we call bottom-up research for every investment, right? So we really come and pull in what the direct competitive set is, what are the demand drivers and what's the potential supply for each investment. We look at and we try to come up with a proprietary rent growth number for that, right? Wow. So that research team is fundamental to not only our overall strategy, but how making, I think, smart investment decisions. And then we obviously have an acquisition team. Their job is to be out there and hunt for new deals, exactly. Right? So it's important we as the portfolio management team communicate our strategy to those acquisition folks so they know what we're looking for. And, sure. and they're out in the markets meeting with brokers, always looking for new investments. And then we have a large group of senior asset managers who are really the CEOs of their properties, right? So we buy a property. We're not the property manager, but we are the owners of the building. We manage budgets, manage capital projects, negotiate leases, and make investment decisions on how to run the asset and run the property. Yep. I mean, that's where the asset managers come in. Those are shared resources. And then the portfolio management team, like myself, we then are the ones who are out there taking all the data, listening to our clients and investors, and coming up with our portfolio strategy. Yep. And articulating that. So that's so you have the portfolio management team, you have the asset managers, the acquisition team, and the research team. And that those are the main groups of the firm that drive investment. And they're, with the exception of the portfolio managers, they're all kind of a shared resource that we all use.
So for the separately managed accounts, what is the back and forth of a pension kind of outlining like the investment philosophy of a fund? Like, do they have say per se in like, hey, we're bullish on industrial, or like, how does that relationship work in the pen or for any separately managed fund? Like, is it more collaborative process of, or is it, hey, this is the return we need to meet for our folks? Like, how does that relationship work?
All right, it's a great
question.
If you
can talk about it.
No, I mean, the reality is it completely varies, right? So some of them are, say, you are the investment manager. We wanted, our goal is to get this sort of total return over the long term. Like, how would you create a portfolio? And they look for our recommendation. And then, to be honest, and give us full discretion to do that within there. Yep. Obviously, communication is really important, like it is in any part of business and in life. But but you have discretion to make investment decisions. And then some are much more idiosyncratic, and they are seeking specific goals that are targeted, right? So we want you to buy, I'm being a little bit extreme, but office, you know, in the Pacific Northwest or something, right? Yeah. And then that becomes a strategy. And so it really does vary, and clients have completely different investment parameters. Because don't forget, sometimes they're thinking of their portfolio as a whole, and they might have...
That's right.
They might already have... If their target for real estate is 10%, they might already have 8, and it might be really weighted to warehouses, so they want something else, right? Yeah. So that's where they're thinking of their portfolio holistically, and we sometimes are a sleeve of that.
This is a little off topic, but going down that route. So with real estate being obviously, and usually, with the exception of kind of what you guys are doing with the real estate income fund, a very illiquid asset class, but for me, let's say running a pension fund, whoever it may be, let's say it's 70% stock and bond, and then you have this other 30% that's going to be real estate. How difficult is it to balance the illiquid nature? Because are they used to, like, you can almost control more of a cash balance in those, like, depending on the market, very easily, right? Just with click of a mouse. What are the complexities of working with a pension with an illiquid asset class? Like, is it challenging to meet their overall cash reserves needs compared to in balancing the whole portfolio, if that makes sense?
Oh, no. I mean, it's really the fundamental question of sort of private real estate, because you're getting, I would argue, an illiquidity premium for the asset class, right? So the fact that you can't buy it and sell it every day allows it to be less volatile, have lower correlation, strong income, and strong total return. So there is benefits to a private asset class, and real estate, to your point, is a sort of a long-term durable asset that takes time to trade, right? Sure. In your experience, I mean, it takes at least 60 to 90 days to buy a building, right? Yeah. So to your point, there's the negatives of illiquidity bring positives. And so I think a pension fund, when they think of putting, say, 10% in private real estate to diversify their portfolio and get those other benefits, yes, they're understanding that they don't have liquidity in this part of their portfolio. Mm-hmm. And for a pension fund, that generally works because they have long, they have short and long-term needs, and they can manage duration that way. Now, the individual investor, where we're trying to head towards, you know, I would argue that individual investors don't need 100% liquidity either. So, we as individuals can begin to think of our portfolios and maybe take advantage of the illiquidity premium as well. And we can talk a little bit more about the income fund and how we manage liquidity for more of the individual investor, but big picture, that is the whole notion that we're trying to achieve of balancing the benefits of this asset class with the liquidity. And your question is 100% spot on, and it's I think as people are looking at alternatives for their portfolios on the individual side, it's trying to teach people that you don't need to be able to sell your whole portfolio every day.
Yeah, right? With the click of a mouse.
Because, by the way, actually, that's probably not the smartest thing to do. Because when you're most scared to do it, it's probably when you probably shouldn't, right? Right. But that's, I know humans are humans and we act certain ways.
Yeah, it's a good point. It kind of creates a behaviorally better product in a way without being able to liquidate everything with the news. So before we get into your fund, the one thing that sticks out on the website, obviously $80 billion under management sticks out, but just like 20 years ago, I think maybe at the time you started, it was just $6 billion. And you have these, not necessarily joint ventures, but recapitalization events with different acquisitions of you guys in partnership. So can you walk through, like, how does one company go from $6 billion to $80 billion in 20 years? So different recapitalization events, and then was there anything else that was a major driver of that? Were there new funds? Were there new SMAs that or new markets that you went to for SMAs to bring in that? Because it's a significant jump.
So I'd say the big trend that is consistent with the whole theme here is private real estate, to that point about understanding the asset class, and it's also maybe data and technology has changed. Yeah. But the way people invest, right? Pension funds the transition from defined benefits to defined contribution has been happening during that 40-year period, right?
Point.
So the asset class went from those separate managed accounts that were, you know, $200 to $500 million minimum investments to a series of commingled funds that are private funds for institutional investors, and I'll talk about how we sort of set those up in a minute. Then now towards more of this individual investor. So that's the theme, I would say, that's consistent with how we've grown our business.
Yeah.
We fortunately, to your point about capitalization of our firm, we were part of ING for about 15 years from the late 90s through the early 2000s. They brought seed capital to the table for us, which allowed us to start commingled funds. So about 20 years ago is when we really started the commingled fund business. We have a large diversified fund in that space. And then we have a large industrial fund in that space, and we have a large multifamily fund in that space. And those two of those were small acquisitions relatively that we've grown over time. But I think we've been the way we focused our business is to create these scaled businesses of sort of steady, consistent funds, and really diversifying our investor base again from the largest institutions of the world to then those commingled funds allowed, you know, a regional pension fund to put $5 or $10 million into private real estate with quarterly liquidity.
Interesting.
And then it's then transitioned. Now we were purchased by Legg Mason, which was purchased by Franklin Templeton.
Yep.
We still own 20% of our firm, but 82% was bought by them. That we strategically did that so that we could expand our investor base to the individual investor. So
because of their platform or resources or just the capital, just selling that, creating
it's more. So we learned that, you know, you need to create a brand, and you need to have salespeople out in the market that have connections to the different distribution channels, whether it's independent broker dealers, the wirehouses, or registered investment advisors. You need folks in those markets that are meeting with them every day.
Absolutely.
And they need to be able to sell your product. And that's what the Franklin Templeton distribution network has brought to us.
Wow.
And that was a strategic decision. We bought ourselves back from ING with a private equity firm, and then we capitalized ourselves with what became Franklin Templeton.
Got it.
And that was, again, to understand that we were shifting our investor base from those largest institutions to the individual investor.
Wow. Well, I think that's a good jumping point to talk about Clarion Partners Real Estate Income Fund, or CPREIF. So 2019, so When did Franklin Templeton partnership happen? Was that 2020 or 2019?
So Legg Mason invested into Clarion in 2016. And then we launched Clarion Partners Real Estate Income Fund in September of 2019.
Yep.
And then Franklin Templeton announced its purchase of Legg Mason in 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic. So we launched the fund, we had a global pandemic, and then our distribution partner got merged. So that, it was an exciting pandemic, I guess, for us. But yes.
And you outlined a little bit of this, and we chatted about it a little bit before, but this has, so to speak, not been the brand for Clarion for a long time, to be this public, right? You guys have been this behemoth in the shadows for a long time. What prompted this shift, or I guess, why did you guys want to create this fund? And if you want to give an overview of the fund, and then we can kind of dig into it a little too.
Sure. So I think we were always
natural progression.
Yeah. I mean, it is this natural progression. We created these scaled funds, and then we noticed the investor base was shifting to the individual investor. Yep. There were competitive products that were launched in the 2017 range that were becoming successful by competitors that, you know, had good institutional brands. And so we believe that. And then I think the technology of how to value our assets and had changed enough that you could do it in a way that you could have a fee low enough that we were comfortable that our investors could be successful. Right. So, you know, the history of these products had tend to have higher fees, and investors maybe didn't do as well because of that. And we believe that we could bring our platform to this space with that partnership, expand our investor base, and it was time that we could do it in a way that could be successful for everyone. And that was really our goal. So the fund, it's called Clarion Partners Real Estate Income Fund. Yep. It was actually the first of its kind that's a 40 Act fund, which brings investor protections that's taxed as a REIT. And so it actually has a ticker. We have a daily share price. It's called CPREX. And you can type that in every day. You know what your investment's worth. It's a minimum investment of $2,500. So really, it's tried to bring the liquidity and simplicity and ease of access to a broader investor. And it really has the same investment prowess as all of our funds, because you're using the same resources as everyone. So that was really the goal of partnering with what became Franklin Templeton, was to create something like this. You know, it takes time, as you said, to build your brand, get out there.
Sure.
Obviously, to have Franklin get comfortable in the alternative space, which they have done. We're well poised today, and that's kind of the big picture.
Yeah. So the pricing is unique, right? Just because real estate is not this asset that's priced daily. So the assets are they have a valuation monthly, and then the income from, I guess, each month is then stretched over the 30 days.
That's right. So, I mean, you think about it, make it very simple. If you owned one apartment and you were paying me rent, I would know how much kind of every day net income I'm getting.
Right.
So we basically accrue that income. So every day you owe me $20 and I pay $10 for the expenses. So I get $10 a day. So basically that just accrues to the share price. That was a very simple example.
Sure.
And then, that's right. Every month, a third party appraiser values every asset. So, real estate's not changing value daily, because it takes 60 days to trade an asset anyway.
Absolutely.
So I think the monthly is an appropriate time frame for the appraiser to update the values of each of our assets. And then annually, that appraiser hires another appraiser to go to the asset. So they don't go to the asset and take pictures and do a full-blown
walk through
every month. They do that once a year. Wow. That would be costly and cumbersome, right? But so they do what we call a desktop valuation monthly, and then annually someone goes and does the full blown appraisal where with everything. So
wow, how did you guys determine the fund size? So it's like $700 million the fund right now. Like
correct.
How did that? When you bring a new fund to market, how does that work? Like, where do you decide like what space you want to fit in, like market cap, so to speak? Like, how do you determine like how much you want to raise for an initial fund? It was something like,
interesting. I mean, the goal is to create a scaled perpetual vehicle here, and so, I mean, we want to create a fund that's in the $2 to $5 billion range, potentially larger. And so that's the goal. And again, this capital, as we get on, you have to get on platforms, and then you have to be with the network, and you can then access the clients of that platform once you're on those platforms.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the goal is to become in the several billion dollar range. We've created curated portfolios on the institutional side, as I mentioned earlier, that are in the 10 to $30 billion range. Mm-hmm. And we've done that by building asset by asset and doing that over time. So we're comfortable that we can manage that scale. And it's a nice balance of having capital come in at a steady pace at a rate that we can invest it in a comfortable way. And that's what's been occurring. And so we've been able to manage the fund, and do that. But that is the challenge, right? Is to manage your dollars, because we get dollars in every day, basically, right? We pay distributions out monthly to investors. And then this does have quarterly liquidity. So if you want to get your money out, it comes on a quarterly basis. And that gets back to that illiquidity that we started talking about on the bigger level earlier. Yeah. But
okay. So this was one of the biggest questions I had then. So you're at 700 million now, and you want to scale over time. Well, I guess two different questions. The first question being, what is the rollout process for the fund? Like, are you going to, I guess I don't understand that part. Do you have to raise all of the capital and then go buy the assets, or were the assets on the book in different portfolio? Like, what is the first 6 months or year of creating a fund? Like, how do you get the capital
without? So we had Franklin gave us seed capital. So we had some seed capital that gave us, we bought all of the assets for this fund.
Yep.
Franklin gave us $175 million to start the fund, and that let us buy assets and grow in over time to create a portfolio. Okay. And so there is seed that helps
that
do that.
Sense.
And then to your point, as you're on these platforms and you grow every day, we find out what cash comes in.
Yeah.
Cash comes in. We have a line we can pay down. We have a pipeline of new investments. So it is timing those flows in, monthly distributions out, quarterly tenders, and making new hard assets. And then we have a liquidity sleeve that invests in commercial mortgage-backed securities and residential mortgage-backed securities, which also provides liquidity. So we have multiple levers to press to manage those ins and outs, and that's what we're trying to do. But the seed was what gave us the capital to start the fund and grow a portfolio without no. But to your point, right? How do you? There was definitely a cart horse problem or something
that's
of that nature.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Yeah.
So, and we didn't talk about this before, so I'm very interested here. So, asset managers obviously are responsible for their asset, right? When there's plenty of work, and then you guys have third-party property managers. But for you as a portfolio manager, and maybe on a couple others, but speaking about this one, how does that work? What is your day-to-day, right? So you have property managers that are in the mix, and you may not communicate there, but you have asset managers of all of these different assets, and you have all these different regions that roll up into your fund. How does that work? What is your day-to-day as a portfolio manager of this fund? Like, what do you focus on? What do you do?
Every day is exciting. So, but I'm fortunately having the Clarion Partners platform, there's a process here that's working, right?
Sure.
So the positive is I don't need to invent this. Like it all, people know what they're doing and they
right.
do it.
Right.
And we have mechanisms for, incentivizing and holding them accountable.
Sure.
So that works quite well. But what I do every day is really think about strategy for the fund. So, where are we allocating capital? Are we being, and how do we build this curated income stream? So if you think about it, I think of it like we every time we buy a property, we're buying leases, right? Or the ability to sign a lease.
Yeah.
And so as a fund, you're trying to create a series of these leases that provide the ability to have stability for our investors to know that they're going to get that monthly distribution, but then to grow it over time. And so we're thinking about how to create that curated portfolio of leases that provide both the stability and the potential growth for the people that invest with us. So that's what we think about doing. Now, how do you do that? You look at trends. So we use our research team to look at the trends and the tailwinds in the warehouse and apartment sector. We were talking about that earlier, right?
Yep.
You look at the pricing too, right? So it's great to have tailwinds, but if people are overpaying for something, doesn't make a lot of sense to do it. So then you have to look at capital markets and pricing.
Sure.
And we overlay that. And then we're looking at sort of macroeconomic themes and interest rates and how are we going to build up a little more dry powder right now and be a little more cautious. And that's what we've been doing for the last 18 months.
Yep.
And so I'm trying to think strategically about how the portfolio is positioned, what sectors we want to push the go button. And then I spend a lot of time talking to folks on these platforms to onboard onto platforms. And then once we're on platforms, let people know about this fund because because to your point, you know, historically, when you're managing private funds, you don't need to be out, you know, growing your brand and letting people know about what you're doing. So I spend a lot of time thinking strategically and articulating our strategy. And then we have, there's actually four of us that manage the fund. And then we have, I have other partners that spend a bit more time talking to those asset managers that, that every day of what's going on at our properties, what's our performance doing. I do that too, but a little bit, I'm a little more sort of outward focused, and we have other folks that are a little more inward that then manage the acquisition and asset management process on a day-to-day basis. And so, but as a portfolio manager, that's what you do, right? You think strategically, you articulate your strategy both internally and externally, and then you manage the resources of the asset management acquisition teams to implement your strategy on a daily basis.
Yeah. So obviously in this world, deals don't come up in this, like, or you may have a deal funnel, but you don't know which deal is ever going to mature, or like when you can get in or get out or buy. So let's say you have new capital in the fund to allocate, or you have a cash balance that you want to move into an investment. How are you determining, hey, we want to allocate more money towards multifamily, but there are no multifamily deals that are ready to execute on? And I know you have a big emphasis on industrial and multifamily in here, but like, and then also the different investment types. You have preferred equity. There's maybe a JV deal in there too. Direct equity, mezzanine loans, and some other debt products. Like, how is all of that, like, how are you baking the pie, so to speak? And deals are not necessarily coming in the streamlined way. But you also want to keep your overall asset allocation in these buckets. Like, how does that work?
I mean, you did a great job articulating all the challenges, right? Because you're trying to, and that's that, again, managing an illiquid asset class with more liquidity of it coming in daily and paying distributions monthly and tenders quarterly. So, I mean, that is the challenge. And that's why we're having a platform where you have access to the investments we do. We at least see where the capital markets are, and we can make better decisions or hopefully good decisions. But then you are also articulating, well, we have different tools as well, right? Yeah. So in the short term, there's been a real dearth of capital. So we've been actually lending a lot more because the actual income returns and total returns of debt investments today are quite compelling because of the obviously interest rates going up and the dearth of capital in that space. So there's a bit of a capital market opportunity today that we can take advantage of, and we still want to make those investments in the sectors we have conviction around. Yeah. So we want those to be more in the multifamily space or in the warehouse space if possible. And there's different ways to do it. And so we try to be flexible and understand, keep the themes consistent of where we see the trends in the space, and then have different tools that we could be flexible about how to implement the strategy. But to your point, if we're seeing compelling industrial investments and the multifamily assets aren't trading today, that's your thesis.
Sure.
Then we're going to, you know, we can go a little more towards warehouse, right, in the short term, and then we can see how capital markets adjust over time, right? So that's where we have to be broad enough in our conviction to not be focused on, you know, you can't say, I want to buy a multifamily asset in South Carolina.
Sure.
Because then if you can't find one, you can't do it, right?
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So it is a balance of using different tools, keeping your thematic ideas consistent and broad enough that you can make investments, and being flexible, right?
Sure.
But also at this time, right, our liquidity sleeve is yielding in the high single digits, right? So it's not the worst time to be building. The positive of interest rates going up is actually having some capital in those investments is not the worst thing right now. So it's okay to be a little more cautious, build up some liquidity, and let's see how the capital markets kind of hopefully free up a bit more, you know, in the next 3 to 6 to 9 months, right? So as that 10-year hopefully stabilizes, or maybe potentially, well, we'll see where it goes. But even a stabilized 10-year where it is, I think capital markets will begin to free up, right?
So a couple things that I'm curious about. So in a way, this tightness of the market, right? And we talked about some geographic regions being tighter, like the southern space, just where insurance costs are high. Obviously, interest rates are high for all of us. But it has created some bit of difficulty in trading deals. But in the absence of trading and acquiring new deals, you have this high single digit return on cash, which is kind of unique and kind of can stabilize the fund in a different way. The second thing that stood out, so are you lending on deals, and I saw some of the recent deals, you're supplying debt on these properties? Are you essentially lending on deals that you guys would like to own, or is there some component to that? Not that it would ever happen, but like, is that the investment philosophy of like, we're going to lend on a property that, you know, you're, I guess you're investing in a different way, right?
Correct. Well, first, we do underwrite them like equity investments. So okay. We're not a bank, right? We do. So even the structured investments, like the preferred equity or mezzanine loans, are underwritten as an equity owner. So yes, we are comfortable in owning them because we've underwritten them and we think of them like equity investments, even though they're structured, right? We have a team that specializes in structuring these investments. And so we generally originate them. We negotiate the agreements with the lender ahead of us and the borrower behind us. So we think of it that way. But I do also think we would make investments in that space. It does open up the universe of potential investments a bit more because you're not looking for upside in those investments, and you have equity protection behind you, so you have downside protection. So there's investments that you would make that you maybe wouldn't want to do as equity that you would do in that space because you might not see the growth potentially there, but you're getting paid as income. And so there's times that it's a great tool to do. That you'd be comfortable to own at the basis you'd own at.
Sure.
But you might not love to own it as equity, but the returns are compelling and the yields are compelling on the debt side.
Yeah.
That was a little bit nuanced, but I hope it made sense.
That makes sense. Yeah. Wow. So digging in one layer deep and then we can come off the fund. But so looking through all the investments, there's some new acquisitions on these build to rent. I'm curious what attracted you to that. And two, what is the source of all of these deals, I guess, without giving away your secret sauce in the acquisition side here? But is it just really strong relationships with regional brokers that you guys are getting these assets? Because almost each one of them on the little fund sheet there says acquired at below replacement costs, all of them. I'm like, oh, well, that's pretty significant to consistently buy good deals. Obviously, that's what you want to do every time. But I guess, how does it work day to day in those regions? Like, is it just going out and those folks, those regional folks on your acquisition team, or just building relationships with brokers? Like, how are they buying such good deals so consistently, it seems like?
So you asked first about the build to rent. So, I mean, so thematically, right, we like multifamily. We've talked about that. We could go as deep as you like, but there is a bit of a combination of affordability and demographic, right? So you have, you know, millennials getting older. We're all getting older, I guess, but millennials entering their sort of family stage. prime earning, prime spending years. And so, you know, I think as you think of folks living, you know, above the bar for 5 years of their life, and then they transition to a different part of life, especially with interest rates going up, there's just a different desire for a different type of housing. And the build to rent. So a build to rent community is similar to an apartment complex in that it generally has a clubhouse and sometimes a pool or something like that. And it's similar to a garden style apartment, maybe, except physically, instead of a series of apartments sort of built together in a building, they're actually basically little houses, right? And sometimes they might be attached or they might be detached, but every person gets their own little house, right? With a very little yard, right? But if you have a dog, you can let your dog out. And so it has the community amenities, but everyone gets their own space and has a little bit more space. And so really it's just a theme of understanding the demographics, which are driving real estate, which are, you have a large wave of folks that are getting a little bit older and have different needs. And we're trying to understand that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think affordability is continues to be an issue with what we've seen with inflation, but also with interest rates going up on the housing side. So I think the build-to-rent communities, the likelihood is that folks might be not buying for a little bit longer, and there's a theme there to invest with, right? And so that's the desire for the build-to-rent communities.
It's a great product, yeah.
And then, absolutely. I mean, it is a great product. There isn't a lot of it, right? Because it's hard to find sites in places that you want to be that you can build those types of communities.
That are undeveloped,
right. So it's more in the South, and it's and like, you know, we've done something in Phoenix and Tampa. So it's those type of markets that you can you could do it in, where there's still enough space to find, right? Because you have to have enough land to be able to build a product like. As for how do we find investments, I mean, we have a almost 30-person acquisition team that's in markets, just what you're saying, right? So it's really just being in your market and knowing what you're looking for and building relationships. This is a relationship business, and your word matters. So you when we transact, we try to be we always do our due diligence up front. We always go to the table with what we think is the best we can do. And when we say we can do something, we do it, right? Or we try to do it. Yeah. If we find out new information after, like we're going to be good to our investors and negotiate, but yeah. you know, your word matters and you try to be a good, straightforward executor in your space. And that's how we've built our brand. And that's what we try to do. So, you do your work up front, you have good relationships. And that's sort of the theme of how we've done business. So.
Yeah. Wow. As far without, I guess, diving in again to your secret sauce here, as far as like underwriting deals at a high level, is there anything like, are there target returns that you look to get in and out of? Obviously the market can certainly change that with interest rates and kind of standard cap rates, depending on the asset class. But like when you're underwriting an apartment deal or industrial, is there any what is your underwriting criteria, or is it more it just needs to fit the specific gap that it needs to fill in the portfolio?
I mean, we do obviously 10-year cash flow models for everything we invest in. Yep. We then diligence all of those assumptions. That's standard, right? That's what I think most folks like ourselves do.
Sure.
And so but it's a market driven process, right? So we have our proprietary rent growth. So it's a little bit of what markets do we think the rent growth will be stronger than the market does is a little bit of the answer, right? Because if we're using our proprietary rent growth and we think with our data that this submarket will average 4% rent growth over the next 5 years and the market thinks it's 3.5 or 3, we're going to get that's a right. higher return. And, and so a little bit is relying on that data that we're coming up with all the product we own, all the, you know, we own 1500 properties, right? We're in these markets. And it's really trying to understand the dynamics of that rent growth,
right?
And then it's client specific of what yields we're looking for, what we're looking for our investors, and how do we find assets that price to the returns that our investors are looking for, and the yields we're trying to make, right? So, I mean that's kind of the simple. And then you look at things like replacement costs. And to your point, that I mean, right now, a lot of things are trading at or below replacement costs. So that's actually. That's a good sign, right? You're much happier buying below replacement costs than you are above replacement costs, because if demand stays strong, at some point they're going to need to build again, and somehow the math is going to shake out to that. So that's a good place to be. But that doesn't equate to returns in the short term. You still need to model out how the returns shake out.
That makes sense. Is there anything we missed pertinent for you to discuss in regards to the fund, the real estate income fund here?
No, I think it's great. I think it's a continuation of understanding where investors are, and you know, we're excited to work with Franklin to you know, expand our investor base. And it's just it's kind of a natural. I mean, you did a great job asking questions about our progression as a firm, and I think it's just the natural next step for us. So.
Yeah, building a product for where people are going to be. So. On each show, obviously, the Deal Ranch, we highlight a deal. You said you had one that I don't really think I know too much about. So we'd love to hear about it. This, which one? What was the one that we were talking about before?
So there's a this stems back more towards the separate account that
I
manage,
yeah.
Which was a build to core strategy. And I think it sort of ties together some of you know, our firm's philosophy and my philosophy on, and brings back almost the urban design side of things of looking for places, looking where things are going. And so the strategy for the fund at the time was to build assets and hold them for the long term. So it was a multifamily asset in Nashville in the North Gulch. And at the time, it's a site just on the northern end of the Gulch. The southern part of the Gulch had been built out, and they were building actually high-rise construction. This was one of the last sites where you could build, you know, we call it stick on podium, right? So you build a parking deck, and then you build stick on top of it. So it's nice to always be that to that replacement cost number. If you're the last person building a lower density product in a market where they're building higher density product, you're kind of below replacement cost the day you finish, even though you just built a property, right? So that was sort of a thesis there. And again, the site was, when we started, had all vacant land around us. And when we completed, we had, you know, there's many tenants from HCA. There was another new multifamily with a Publix, and a number of office, multifamily, retail, and a hotel actually were built within two blocks of us, you know, during the lifetime of us once Wow. we broke ground. So I think it just, sometimes you need to have a little bit of a vision. It's a little scary when you go there at the beginning, when you're at the northern end of the site and there's blocks of vacancy around you. But if you can sort of see where the world is headed, you know, we're not trying to sort of pioneer new locations here, but I think you can see that there's that whole Nashville had just was transitioning massively. Absolutely. And then Amazon obviously announced its project shortly thereafter. And it's really a focus on, I almost call them next gen cities of these, you know, I think Austin sort of started it, Denver, Nashville, these cities that are, you know, diverse economies with often state capitals, great universities, broad economies. Nashville has healthcare, actually the auto industry. And then the music industry brings something kind of cool, right? So each of these cities have, you know, Austin had the Keep It Weird thing, Denver has the mountains. So each of these cities had that sort of high quality of life, diverse economies, relative affordability, that's really attracted people with good jobs, right? So that's kind of the mix that we've been looking for. And in Nashville, we were actually the first to invest in a multifamily in Nashville and to do to build this project in an area that hadn't been built yet. And then it worked out, you know, really well. But it was kind of, I think, bringing the themes of all that we were trying to do together to do that.
Wow. So what year was that? When did the deal originate?
So that was 2016 when we started that. We worked with Twilliger Pappas to do it. And so, you know, they to their credit, they're the ones who found the site, right? Pulled it together, right? So
we're the capital. How did it come together? Who brought you the deal? Where did the deal originate?
So again, it's a relationship business, right? Yep. So they, to their credit, they're the ones who had the vision, did the legwork, right? We are just the equity capital. And we fully respect that. But they also, but I mean, it's important to have the capital to do it and that relationship's important. And so they really found the site, worked, you know, it was from a local utility to get control of it, got all the planning and zoning. They actually worked to that point about the construction type. They actually decided to de-densify the site a bit to have a little more space, have, you know, a dog park, you know, the amenity race is on. So you needed a dog park. There's actually a podcast because it's Nashville. There's a podcast studio. I think it's one of the only ones in one of our properties.
Wow.
We should
That's
go there
crazy.
Next time.
Yeah,
maybe we should have a beer and do it there.
That's
next
right.
time. But,
we can bring Allie on.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's how that, and then it was a relationship with them to make the transaction happen. So
Is this an asset that you guys still own, or what did the exit on it
look like? It was the Guthrie. Actually, we bought Twilliger Pappas out. We owned it for the longer term. And then we recently sold it. Again, that's where, to your point about illiquidity and the fund transitioned to a later stage in its life where it was needing more cash. And a lot of the pension funds, right, as the balance of where equity, they want to keep a steady state of real estate in their portfolio. So they're always trying to rebalance their portfolio. Yeah. So they actually recently sold it, and it was a great asset, and it did well for them. But so what was that? 16 to
7 years.
So 7 years. So that's, I mean, that's a
standard good hold.
Yeah, that's a good hold. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think when we built it, we thought we'd hold it, you know, for. I use the word forever. I know
yeah, of course, forever. We all do.
But 7 years wasn't a bad run, so it's good.
It's a good asset. In wrapping up, so to speak, here, what are you guys focused on now? Besides obviously bringing this fund's been to market, I guess, for 4 years now. Is there anything new that you haven't? A new asset class, an asset class, a market, a fund. Is there anything you guys haven't done as Clarion that you want to do? Yourselves that you have a new space that you haven't broken into.
Well, it's interesting
I
mean, if you look at sort of office, right, we've been underweight office, we've been way overweight warehouse. So those are positives. I think the themes that we, and if you think of office was for the 40 years up to 2017, office was 40% of the institutional space, right? I mean, look up Park Avenue and see.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where 40% of private real estate assets were, right? And now that's down to 20 and it's headed down lower. And so where does that 20 to 25% of private real estate go is a little bit the question. It goes to alternatives. It goes to other forms of housing. We talked about build to rent.
Yep.
And so I think we're focused on growing our business, not only by expanding our investors more towards the individual, but looking how to take advantage of what we call alternatives in the private space, and whether that's different types of housing, more life science, self-storage, those type of assets are how we're focused on growing our business, and understanding how to A, grow our business, but B, to a certain extent, replace that part of the institutional
yep.
private real estate space that was office, which is now other things.
Last question for you. I know we've been here for a good bit of time. Along the way, right, this being a heavy relationship business, who do you think in your career has helped you the most? A couple people if you need to. But like, who do you think, whether it be a mentor or someone you just learned a lot with or worked with, who do you think helped you the most in your career in this business?
I think there were a number of people. I didn't come from real estate, so yeah. I didn't have that as a family background. So I've yeah. been fortunate to learn a lot. I'd say as an architect, the senior partners of our firm that I mentioned earlier were leaders, and they actually helped me go to business school, and they were supportive of transition and that type of thing. And then when I was hired here by a fellow named Michael O'Brien, who works around the street here, who was a big proponent in my career and helped me transition. And that's one reason I came to Clarion. And then since then, you know, our senior leadership here of Dave Gilbert and Hugh McDonald are been great supporters and help build my career out. So, I mean, it's a really great question, and it's important in your life to find people that are role models that you respect and help you, that are supportive of you, but help you kind of grow, because it's actually really a key thing to do. It's hard to do it by yourself. So
very tough to do it by yourself. I think that's a good stopping point. It's a real quick thanks to Sarah Young for setting this up, and then Chris Sullivan at Crafting Capital, and then Allie and everyone else working on the fund for coordinating this event. So thanks for coming on. I appreciate it, Rick.
Thanks for getting up early to see me. It's nice. So thank you. And thanks for the coffee.
Absolutely.